Blog Talk Radio.
All right, welcome everybody to Ron Brooks Show, and today is our monthly Patreon contributor show where I take live questions from some of my best Patreon contributors. We've got a treat though today. We've got Ben Baer, who I just did the interview on conspiracy theories, the Catholic Church, and abortion. He's joining us for today, so feel free, Jennifer, Darius, Jonathan, to also ask Ben questions related or unrelated to a discussion from a few days ago. And of course, I will be taking Super Chat questions on YouTube, so feel free to ask their questions about anything, right? This is open Q&A, but we are going to start with our supporters here on Patreon. Let me just do this. All right. Why is it doing that? One second. I'm working on the video and how to get this. I want to get it so it speaker view. Okay. I don't know why Jennifer is the speaker when I'm speaking, but can everybody see Jennifer? Can you all see Jennifer?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. All right. So, I'll try to flip between the different video shots. So this is open. It's up to you. Any questions you guys want, Jennifer, you want to get started?
Okay. Can you address the idea, the fallacy really, that you use faith every day when you, for example, make a decision, you buy some gas, and you don't actually measure that it's 5 gallons, you're, quote, accepting it on faith. Can you address that?
So the confusion between faith and trust and belief and all these kind of concepts. Well, I'm gonna shift that since I've got Ben here, since I've got a philosophy here, I might as well take advantage of that. So Ben, do you wanna start us on that?
This is a question that comes up a lot. And I remember from one of my earliest days in philosophy, my very first philosophy class, professor used this kind of question as a kind of indirect argument for religious belief. And I think it depends on a package deal, two things that are sometimes called faith that are very different from each other. And one is belief without evidence. And that's what advocates of religious belief often want you to have. But in common parlance, people sometimes say, take me on faith, when they mean, trust me because I saw something that you didn't see. And those are very different things, because we have reasons to trust people sometimes, often. I mean, if you think about how much you know about the world that depends upon basically the testimony of other people, it's an enormous amount of your knowledge. It's upwards of 80, 90%, maybe more, because you've never been to many countries in the world. You weren't alive more than 30 years ago. You have to rely on people who were witnesses to history or who are witnesses to the current events around the world. But we don't believe them without reason. We know that they're human beings who have brains and eyes and can witness things just like we can. And if unless we have a reason to think they'd lie to us on something, we have lots of reasons to think that they'd want to tell us the truth. And so that this is one of the reasons why, when you're evaluating the reliability of some kind of journalistic institution, you want to look at their track record. You want to see, well, how often and in how many egregious sorts of ways have they gotten things wrong? Do they bother to make corrections when they get things wrong? And it's a very tricky thing to evaluate in a lot of cases. Especially when you know that people have ideological agendas that can distort the things that they observe. But it also helps to know the difference between the kinds of things that even ideological commentators are more likely to get right and are more likely to get wrong, because there's a big difference between just relaying some observation about some fact or figure or who said what to whom, versus your interpretation of that very concrete fact, what its significance is, It's the difference between the concrete and the abstract, and it helps to have a little bit of background in epistemology to make that difference, to understand that difference, and then to judge people according to it. But bottom line is, we have reason to trust people on some things they tell us, on many things they tell us, not everything they tell us, and you have to think about the difference. But you need to trust them, because otherwise we wouldn't know anything about the world.
And indeed, but one of the differences is we can cross-reference, we can check, we can test, we can look for other evidence, we can look at other authors and whether other authors confirm what they're writing. In some cases, we can actually go and witness it ourselves if somebody said something on a video, particularly today. And that's the difference between the kind of faith that is associated with religion. It's something was revealed to somebody, but it's not revealed to you. And there's no way for you to confirm, to test, to reevaluate, it's a dead end. Faith in that sense is a complete dead end epistemologically.
Not only that, but there's lots of reasons to doubt it. Like, yes, it happened thousands of years ago. There was only one source. There are contradictory sources who say the opposite. The source definitely had an agenda. And more importantly, especially if you're talking about alleged revelations about the supernatural, there's pretty strong reason to think that no amount of testimony in the world can establish the existence of these things, because the content of the claim that's being testified to contradicts logic. And if you have to presuppose logic in order to trust anything. So,
and it has to integrate with all your other knowledge. So again, the whole idea of objectivist epistemology, giving you tools to evaluate other people's testimony, other people's ideas, and they don't want you to integrate it with the rest of your knowledge, because they want you to accept it on faith. They really don't want to provide any evidence, because there is no evidence. So what Ben said, it's a package deal of those two kind of distinct identifications. One is the faith of no evidence, and the other of, yeah, you trust somebody, you believe somebody, and you can verify, or at least you can integrate, you can test.
Reduction and integration are the two seminal tools of objectivist logic, and they're incredibly useful for assessing these kinds of things.
Jennifer, do you have a follow-up?
Yeah, isn't a basic tenet of science is you should be able to replicate an experiment?
I think it's one of the basic tenets. It's very helpful, sure.
Yeah.
You can't – not everything that we know is based on – literal scientific experiments, of course. And it can't be, because even the experiments themselves have to be based on more basic forms of knowledge. So it's true that if the reason you're asking is you can't replicate for yourself every observation that everybody's ever made that you're relying on, that's true.
Yeah.
But when you can replicate it, you should try, for sure, and that'll increase the objectivity of what you're looking at.
Thank you.
Great. Thanks, Jennifer. Darius? Oops.
Oops.
Hello? I unmuted you. You're good now. You're good to go.
Yeah, thank you.
Any questions?
Yeah. I actually wasn't meaning to ask this question, but since Jennifer got us on the topic and Ben went there, I was wondering, Ben, did you are you familiar with some of these kind of so-called logical arguments for the proof of God that some even philosophers at the professor level have? For example, Ben Shapiro had a guest on his Sunday show, I think a week ago. I think his professor Fesser, who's a philosopher, and he put forth sort of a cogent argument based on logic for the proof of God. You must be familiar with this stuff, I assume.
So which one?
There are many.
Yeah, which argument did he use on the bench on the show?
He did several.
Okay.
I won't even begin to try to replicate them. I mean, I would hate to be to go one-on-one again with him. I don't think I could handle it, but I would love to know how a more trained philosopher would deal with it.
Yeah, I mean, there's a number of classical arguments for the existence of God that have been batted around for hundreds, if not thousands, of years. I think that the consensus among philosophers is that they don't work. Now, that doesn't mean that the philosophers are right, especially since the most recent contemporary, usually Christian philosophers, have come up with super sophisticated versions of these arguments that are designed to avoid all the loopholes of the classical ones. Of course, these arguments that these particular professors give are never the actual reasons that most people have for believing in God. So they have the air of sort of a after-the-fact rationalization. But, you know, if the big three classically are the, they call the cosmological argument, which is the idea that the universe exists and something must have caused it. That cause must be God. There's what they call the ontological argument, which is the idea that there's something in the very idea of the notion of God that implies that it must exist, because God's a perfect being and part of perfection includes existing rather than not existing, and so God must exist. And then the third classical argument is what they call the teleological argument, the idea that the universe shows signs of design, complexity and functionality that are associated with intelligence, and therefore there must be an intelligent being that created the universe. You know, we could spend time going through each of those and taking them apart, but I'll just generalize and say that usually each of these arguments, maybe it shows something, it proves something, but it's rarely the kind of thing that the believer wants it to prove. It rarely establishes the existence of an all-powerful, omniscient, intelligent being that created the universe. Maybe it aims at establishing one little bit of that rather than the other. And sometimes they'll say, well, you have to give all three arguments or all as many as there can be to really prove it. So that has issues too. But I don't know, is there one of those that I mentioned that leaps out at you in particular that's worthy of discussion that we could dissect more?
Yeah, I mean, the argument he put forth, the first of several arguments I found, it seemed to be the one you focused on the most. It might be the cosmological argument, as you called it. Basically, he was saying that every kind of potential that exists, underneath it, there's some action. Or I think he used the word actionable. And then you can dig deeper into that, and there's some actionable behind that. And there's some actionable behind that. If you keep going recursively, you logically are stuck with the notion that there has to be a prime action or prime mover at the beginning.
Yeah. And that's Aristotle's argument, right?
Okay.
Sort of. Yeah. And I'm not an expert on Aristotle, but there's lots of different versions of this argument, and they're sometimes run together, and I'm not an expert on all the differences. But I'll say basically two things about this argument. One is that to give it the best benefit of the doubt I can, I would say, well, there's a certain point to the idea that if you look at all the different effects in the world and you think effects have causes and you're trying to understand the universe, you're going to try to dig as deep as you can to understand what kind of fundamental causal factors are underneath all of this. And so there's a certain point that you can't have an infinite regress of scientific explanation. Now, what does that show you? Well, maybe it shows you that you eventually need to find some kind of ultimate particle that explains everything. Does that show you that there's a God? Well, not if a God is defined as, again, like I said before, a super intelligent, omnipotent being who created the universe. There's nothing about the need to halt infinite regresses that establishes a consciousness. And the idea that it does, the idea that you need to appeal to consciousness to explain the universe, is this idea that Ayn Rand calls the primacy of consciousness, the idea that consciousness comes before existence, that it's the basic thing in the universe, and that reality is somehow a product or a creation of consciousness. And I think most people, when they consider the idea minds create reality, they think it's absurd, but for some reason they make an exception when the issue is God. And when you put it to them in those terms, well, when you talk about the idea of a God who exists unto himself and then out of nothing creates the material world, it becomes clear that is a similar kind of primacy of consciousness view, and that involves all the same kinds of contradictions as it does when you're talking about it on the individual level. What is this conscious being conscious of before it creates anything? It's conscious of itself. What is itself? Itself is a consciousness, which is conscious of what? And there's your infinite regress. There's your circularity. That's the main thing I would say about that. And if you're interested in learning more, check out chapter one of Dr. Peacock's book, Objectivism and the Philosophy of Ayn Rand, where he talks about the issue of primacy of existence versus primacy of consciousness and how that bears on the debate about the existence of God.
Oh, great. Thank you.
So what's your primary argument that you would give, again, short, on the teleological argument? You know, there's order in the universe. It's too beautiful, too complex to be random, to be a product of just randomness.
Well, there's a sort of parallel point to make about it, which is that there's a certain point to the argument, which is when you look at the living things and the way in which they are organized to achieve certain goals, there is a similarity between that and the devices of intelligent makers. And the most famous person and most famous thinker in history to notice this similarity and to make something of it was Charles Darwin, who realized, wow, there's a certain kind of selection going on in nature. It's not artificial selection. It's not like when dog breeders breed dogs. It's something that happens just because of natural, unintelligent forces by accident, but because of certain kinds of population and survival pressures. So, yeah, there's an important similarity there, but what it helps provide evidence for, not all by itself, but importantly and crucially, is something like theory of evolution. It by no means establishes the existence of, again, an all-powerful, super-intelligent being. If it did offer any kind of evidence for some kind of intelligent force, it would be much more likely to be, super aliens who came from another planet, because, again, you have the contradictions involved in a purely conscious, magical.
Well, they would also argue that the purely physical world beyond the biological world is too orderly and, right? I mean, because they go even before. It's evidence of a clockmaker, right?
Yeah, that's a slightly different version of the argument, but they appeal to something called the anthropic principle, which they'll say there are certain physical constants in the universe, which if they're just slightly different, life wouldn't exist.
Yeah.
And that's true, but what it shows is that there's no alternative to existence. That there couldn't have been things the way they are unless reality
had to be the way it is.
But what that means is that reality has to be this way. It can't be another different way. Yeah. It's not like there was different possibilities inherent in the nature of the universe to begin with, and somebody selected.
Good, Jonathan.
Jonathan's muted.
Jonathan, you're muted. You're muted. You're muted. I'll unmute you.
Okay, no, thank you.
Good.
And Yaron, I really enjoyed the podcast you and Ben did together.
Good.
But especially the way that you were able to relate the idea of the arbitrary to conspiracy theories. Quickly, briefly, on this notion of God, made me think of Dr. Peacock did, I think, two shows maybe 20 years ago, radio shows, where he invited people just to call him up and give them their best arguments for God. And it was masterful. All these ones that you mentioned, he was able to do it in a very kind of conversational way. But he took it on all comers, and it was fascinating to listen to just everyday people call in and give their best arguments for God. And kind of, and Ben, quickly, I was surprised to hear you mention that you gave up God, or you kind of started thinking about this at age 16. I was much more like Yaron at much earlier age. From the moment I understood it, I understood that this was a joke, that this couldn't actually be the thing.
I envy you.
He's jealous.
So can you think somebody can start their life until, were you able to start your life really until you rejected the supernatural?
I mean, it's a hard to question to answer, because normally you don't really start your life until you're away from your parents and going to college anyway, and so it just happened to be that it was happening around the same time. Would my life have been better before? college if I had given these things up, probably in certain ways. I think so. Yeah. Don't know if I have more to say about that.
Well, I'll ask one quick follow-up if I could. You know, one of the things Dr. Peikoff always stressed that I always kept with me was his imploring that the arbitrary has no standing. And you made that very clear in your discussion of conspiracy theories. A lot of times, and you and your own touched on this, conspiracy theories have some standing. You know, the Rothschilds do have a lot of money, and there is a place called Bilderberg or something else like that. So, you know, how to kind of approach conspiracy theories when people say, well, I know this is true, but some elements of this true. So it's not just that it's completely arbitrary, but certain elements of it are.
Yeah, well, so I want to clarify something to begin with. I mean, conspiracies really happen. There are some real conspiracies. And you could ask me about ones that I think are real. But so my point, and I think I've already seen a few people misinterpreting me on this. I don't know that you are, but my point is not that there are never conspiracies. It's that there is a certain kind of mentality that is more prone to see them in places where there isn't evidence to support it. And that mentality feeds off of, I mean, in Ayn Rand's view, it feeds off of certain kinds of cultural factors that lead people to be very confused about what's happening, and that people should consider what bigger issues might explain these situations and why things are so bewildering. And in this case, you know, her view is that it's that people agree on basic philosophic ideas, and it's not backroom decisions that are really guiding the course of the world.
So part of it is that even though they are conspiracies are not actually what shape reality. They exist and they can be important, but they're not shaping history. They're not shaping events. What shapes events are philosophical ideas that are out in the open, that everybody knows about them. And even the existence of conspiracies, their ability to succeed, is dependent on the ideas that already exist in the culture. And what people do is they eliminate the ideas. All you're left with some conspiracies that exist. And they say, aha, these conspiracies exist. So, and they explain stuff. So maybe everything's guided now by conspiracies. Because once you take out the real causal factor, then reality is bewildering. Then it truly is hard to understand all the crazy, I mean, truly crazy stuff that happens in the world. And they need an explanation. So they latch onto, look at what Catholic priest does. So why can't Bill Clinton be doing this in an airplane? What was it, Pizzagate or whatever? I can't remember which billionaire he was doing it with on a plane. And that explains, I don't know, why Hillary was XYZ and why Trump got, you know, and then suddenly you've got a multitude of explanations because people need explanation. I mean, this goes back to Ben's comment about religion being the ultimate conspiracy theory. People need explanations about reality. They need to understand cause and effect. They need to know why things are happening. And if they don't have the real cause, they're going to make something up, or they're going to latch onto something real and blow it out of proportion.
Good.
And the important thing about judging claims about whether a conspiracy is actually happening is to think about what evidence for one would actually look like. And we have examples of this. We have examples of conspiracies that have been proven. And the one that I usually like to cite, because I know it best, is the Watergate break-in. Bob Woodward, for example, didn't start investigating this theory because he had an axe to grind against Nixon and was looking for ways to blame Nixon for things. He started because he was a beat reporter who was covering the local DC courts, and these guys who were connected to the reelection campaign for Nixon were suddenly arrested and brought before the judge. And he said, well, that's a little odd. Let me dig deeper. And of course, famously followed the money and got, you know, testimony from Deep Throat. And there's real evidence that he's collecting there. And then eventually it's basically something that Nixon confessed to, and you had tapes and everything. So, I mean, that's real evidence, you know, as opposed to, I was just reading a little bit about the Vince Foster death, which there's, you know, belief that the Clintons had Foster killed. For what reason exactly, I'm not sure. But the overwhelming majority of the arguments that you see for why this is the case is, well, the body was found in a strange circumstance. We're not quite sure why the gun was in his hand the way it was and why the gunpowder in the hand was that. There's all these unanswered questions. There's all these things about the circumstances we don't understand. There's all these anomalies. This is usually the way arbitrary conspiracism works. It points to anomalies, little, you know, things in the evidence that we have that they don't have a theory for, and then they infer, oh, because we don't understand this, it must be some powerful force that's trying to hide something from us. And that just doesn't follow logically.
Yeah, I mean, 9/11 was the same thing, right? So the towers fell in a particular way. They fell, you know, they stacked, so they fell like this. And everybody thinks if a plane hits a tower from the side, then it would tilt and fall this way. So why is it falling down? And, you know, you have to know something about construction. You have to know something about engineering. You have to know something about, the science of metals and what happens to metals at an extreme heat. And then they say, but metals don't melt. But, you know, again, metals don't have to melt in order to lose strength. None of the metal melted. It just lost strength. And then, you know, but it's bewildering. It's counterintuitive in some way for somebody who doesn't have strong intuition about construction, about engineering. And nobody spent a lot of time originally explaining how the towers fell. It only turned out that the explanations came after the conspiracy theories were out. So people said, oh, instead of saying, oh, I better study, I better look, I better do some engineering, they immediately came out. And plus, you know, people flying airplanes into buildings, I mean, motivated by what? By religion of peace, that can't be right. So, but the American government, they're always behind, they're always scheming, they're always doing stuff. Maybe it's them or the Israelis or the Jews, or it latches onto some other primitive conspiracy. And then all those unexplained things are added into the irrational fear and the irrational, you know, inability to explain what's going on. And you get the 9/11. And then when you explain the engineering to them, it's too late because they've already so convinced themselves that it doesn't matter anymore.
It's interesting that so many of these views depend are about crimes or wars or historical events. And the thing is, we know in advance that anytime you have a major event involving lots of people that involves accidents, even if it involves various kinds of plotting, there's going to be a million aspects of this that we don't understand, that are difficult to understand.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because we're not there, because we didn't plan it, because
we're not engineers.
And so you have to have a kind of comfort with your ignorance about these kinds of situations, which some people don't. And so they look for patterns where there aren't any.
Yeah. So I've got a bunch of super chat questions, but one is related to conspiracies. I don't even know what it's about, but maybe you do, Ben. He's asking thoughts on the ancient alien conspiracy.
I do have thoughts on this one.
Oh, wow. You even know what it is. I don't even know what the ancient alien conspiracy is.
Yeah, well, this is the view that's pushed. If you watch there's a show on the History Channel.
Okay. The pyramids were built by aliens, that kind of stuff.
Right,
okay.
Right. And it's the same thing. It's we don't understand how these ancient people could have built these pyramids. Therefore, it must be some super conscious being. So it's again, very similar to the argument for religion. One which, incidentally, I should say, underappreciates the fact that people actually do have intelligence and can figure things out. And I think this is a theory that's often encouraged by people's ignorance about history and ignorance about how much ancient civilizations really did figure out. I mean, you think about some of the things that the ancient Greeks, for example, were able to figure out in science, even to some extent technology. It's much less than many college freshmen know. So, of course, college freshmen are going to be really impressed by these theories.
Yeah, and that there are theories about most of these ancient achievements in terms of how they did it. So, one example I was in Pompeii, and in Pompeii, you actually see that they had pipes with running water and faucets. Like 200 years after Pompeii, there were no pipes, there were no faucets. So if you had looked at Pompeii from the perspective of 1000 AD and looking back, you would have said, this is alien technology. There's no way. Nobody in the world today knows. Or I think they built 4 or 5 stories in Pompeii. That technology was lost. There was no knowledge of building anything beyond 2 stories after the fall of Rome. So you would have said, whoa, you know, it must have been alien technology because we don't have the knowledge right now. It's interesting. We assume that knowledge cannot be lost. But history suggests over and over and over again that knowledge can be lost. And I think to some extent we've been experiencing it today. But yeah, that knowledge is lost all the time. All right, we're going to do one more round, and then I'm going to take some more of the super chat. So, Jennifer, any additional questions?
I was watching a show about this nature show, about, and there's these crickets that they went into caves, and they're blind, and they have, like, spaces in their head where they used to have eyes. But so they think they had eyes, and they went in there and became blind because there was nothing to see.
Yep.
It was dark. And I thought that reminded me of, I don't suppose it's really evidence, but sort of like primacy of existence. If there's nothing to see, you don't have any eyes. It's like backwards. Like, is that evidence for that or not really?
That's a tough one because I don't know exactly the example that you're discussing, though I have heard of similar cases. In my case, I think it was a different animal. But the bigger issue is that the idea of the primacy of existence is a philosophical understanding about the basic relationship, basic metaphysical relationship between existence and consciousness, between the mind and reality. So it's not the sort of claim you can give specific scientific evidence for, or that you need to give specific scientific evidence for, whether from biology or anything else, because it is the presupposition of any practice of science. If you think that evidence is important at all in any field of science, biology, chemistry, physics, it's because you think that you can't just make up theories out of whole cloth and expect them to be true by that fact. The reality is out there, and you need to conform your mind to the world, not the other way around. And so, the fact that a creature in the process of evolution ends up losing its sight, and this is an interesting fact that is itself independent of our consciousness, which is an interesting illustration, I think, by the way, of how the theory of evolution works and how the process of evolution works, that when there's no longer a need for an organ, maintaining that organ involves the use of energy. It's no longer to the animal's survival advantage to keep it. So the ones that lose it will have more to do with that energy. But that's an independent question of this philosophic question of whether we need evidence for anything at all, which is what the primacy of existence is all about.
It strikes me, if anything, it's kind of an interesting, not proof, but evidence of, I guess, that suggests that our senses actually give us information about reality. That our senses evolved to do that. And if they don't give us evidence about reality, because let's say there is no reality in the sense of visual stimuli, then they become useless and they drop off. So this idea that our senses are giving us false information is so anti-evolution and anti-biology.
That's a good point. Yeah, I hadn't thought of it that way.
So I think it is evidence of that aspect of the validity of the senses.
I think it's a good illustration.
Illustration. That's how I would put it. It's illustration, yeah. Because it's not proof and it's not evidence exactly, because again, you need senses in order to even know that they've lost their senses, right?
Right.
So it's an axiomatic beginning point, right? But it's a nice illustration of it. Look, see, if our eyes really didn't provide us with evidence, I mean, not that you need this, right? Because you would be run over and there's lots of bad things that would happen to you if your eyes didn't provide you with real evidence about the real world. But here's an animal that went into a different environment and lost them because they were not giving it information. All right. Darius.
Yeah, thanks, Yaron. So, I mean, I've heard you talk a lot about Enlightenment Now by Steven Pinker.
Yep.
And I'm also a fan of the book. I've never heard you mention one aspect from the book that he calls humanism, which is right there in the subtitle of the book. And he has a whole chapter, I think it's pretty much the last chapter of the book, dedicated to it. And, you know, on the one hand, he says, like the goal of humanism is to maximize human flourishing. That's a quote. And that sounds great. But then shortly thereafter, he makes this, just quoting him, working to benefit society maximizes individual happiness, which starts to sound like, you know, thinly veiled collectivism.
Yeah.
So I'm wondering what you think you're on about this whole concept of humanism. That
I mean, I'm sure Ben will have something to say about this, because I think it is related to the history of philosophy and what was going on at the time. But I think humanism is an attempt to have your cake and eat it too, some extent. It's a recognition, I think, that starts somewhere in the Renaissance or post-Renaissance, post-discovery of Aristotle, that there is value in the individual, and there is value in the individual's pursuit of happiness. But an unwillingness to completely abandon, if you will, Christian altruism, and an inability to kind of give the idea of the pursuit of happiness and the individual's, the sanctity of the individual's life, and from a moral perspective, to give it philosophical grounding. So humanism is, I think, a step in the right direction in some sense of saying, well, okay, we recognize as individuals, we pursue happiness, we're trying to make our lives better, all of that is a good thing, but don't give up on this altruism, on, you know, as you said, collectivism, on the need to sacrifice and all of this. We need to have them both. And I can, you know, you can understand that from the perspective of Renaissance into the Enlightenment, where religion is still powerful, religion is strong, and where they don't have a proper theory to ground the idea of individualism, moral individualism. It's far less understandable, I think, in the 21st century. But again, it's an attempt by people like Pinker, although Pinker, like most of these guys, are so contradictory. They hold such contradictory premises, because Pinker doesn't believe in free will, and he questions whether we even are conscious. So it's then you have to ask the question of whether, if you question whether we're conscious and you doubt free will, then what does morality even mean? What do choices even mean, and all that? So put that aside. Just take him on his word in this particular book, ignoring his previous books. He's trying to juggle them both. He's trying to have both his pursuit of happiness and his altruism. And he does the same thing with economics, right? In the book, he says, well, capitalism is good. You can't do without capitalism. We have to have some free markets, but you can't abandon everything to the free market. Oh my God, bad things would happen. So we have to have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, you know, all these other regulations, and he won't tell you exactly how many, and he don't tell you which ones are good and which ones are bad, and what the standard by evaluating which ones are good or what's bad. But we have to have this mixture, because he can't give up on the altruism, he can't give up on the collectivism, and he can ultimately trust the individual. Because again, even though he says we're reason being, but our reason is limited, and, you know, sometimes we're not, and what happens when we, you know, so there's all this, you know, attempt to keep the ancient ideas while acknowledging the power of reason, individualism, and capitalism. And this is the battle for Western civilization, in my view, right? You know, in Pinker, you can see the battle. It's the Western civilization is reason, individualism, capitalism, or some variation of that, right? But there are these forces that are fighting against it, that are undercutting, that are trying to destroy that. And they're in... The better thinkers today are still struggling with it. The bad thinkers today have given up on reason, individualism, and capitalism. The better ones, and I consider Pinker's kind of one of the better ones, are still struggling with that, with those ideas. Ben?
Yeah, I think this is a good question, and I basically agree with your answer, Yaron. I've read the book, and there's some interesting things that happen in that chapter on humanism. So one of them is that he is in one sense, he thinks of himself as a utilitarian who's concerned with the greatest happiness for the greatest number. But he also knows, probably because his wife is a philosopher, he knows that there's a million objections philosophically to this standpoint, and he's sensitive to that fact. And so he sort of takes a step back from it, and he says, well, maybe we're not just talking about any old kind of happiness for the greatest number. It's got to be some kind of flourishing, is the word that he uses. And then he says, you know what the best way to get flourishing is to use what he calls deontological principles. Now, that's language from Kant. So he's trying to blend the kind of consequentialist and deontological ethical traditions by having, well, what are the rules that we need to maximize human flourishing in the long run? On its face, that's not a bad move to make. However, what is the outcome that he's trying to maximize for in the long run? I think you're right that it's still a kind of collectivistic outcome. And here I think it's really significant and important that he denies free will. Because, and this is something we talked about in the interview earlier this week, Yaron, if you want to understand Ayn Rand's view of morality, there are really two basic and important facts that it's based on. One is the biological needs of living organisms, and for human beings, that means reason. I think that on a lot of that point, Pinker's going to line up and agree. It's the second point that you have to choose to use your mind. You have to choose to accept reality, and you have to choose to live. He has no conception of, because he denies free will. And yet that's the point that transforms your kind of generic flourishing consequentialism into an egoist ethic, because so what if there's these policies that encourage lots of flourishing for the rest of society? What does that mean to me? Why does that give me a reason to be moral or to do anything for that matter? And you can't answer that question. And nobody ever has answered that question without saying, well, because and to the extent that certain principles are needed to guide your life. If you want to live, then you need to do these kinds of things. And not everybody does. And so it really does depend on our own individual choices. And that's something that Pinker, as a determinist and denialist of free will, is not in a position to do. And I think that Sam Harris has basically the same issue.
Yeah. Thank you.
Jonathan?
Thanks, Yaron and Ben, to always the great forum. Really quickly, Yaron, quickly for you, if I could. Did you say now there are more copies of Ayn Rand's work sold internationally than domestically? You had mentioned that a couple weeks ago. Could you clarify that?
Yeah, no, it's exactly what you said. More copies of Ayn Rand's books sell outside the United States in a variety of different languages than do in English, or at least in the U.S. And I think the line crossed over, I think, in 2016 or 2017, so recently. And partially is it's a decline in U.S. sales from the very high peaks in 2009 to 2013, U.S. sales were through the roof. But a lot of it is just a huge uptick. I mean, a major uptick in foreign sales. And I think that number is understated significantly, because a lot of the foreign sales don't actually report sales because they don't want to pay royalties. So I think the challenges in getting the reports. So for example, I don't know that we have all the numbers from China. I don't know that we have updated numbers from Russia. Russia, I can tell you that from 2010 to 2013, I think just Ayn Rand in Russia sold more than 100,000 copies a year, which is a huge number just in Russia. But I don't know that we have numbers since 2013. So I think the foreign numbers are messy. The domestic numbers we know. I was just in Brazil, and my hosts were these young entrepreneurs, businessmen under the age of 35. And as part of their organization, it's some organization called the Institute for Freedom and Democracy. Atlas Shrugged is required reading. Everybody has to read Atlas Shrugged, right? And then they do reading groups on Fountainhead, and at the airport in Sao Paulo, we went, Revital and my wife went into the bookstore, and there's a stack of Atlas Shrugged, right, in the airport. Once in a while you see it in an airport bookstore here, but I've said in the past, in Ukraine, Atlas Shrugged is like one of the books sold in the supermarkets, right? Because it's such a bestseller, you know, that's the, it's a book in a supermarket. So, yeah, exciting things are happening outside the U.S.
And Yaron, here's a complimentary fact. We just sent out acceptance letters for OAC students.
Yeah.
Almost half of them are from outside the U.S.
Yeah.
Austria, Greece, Guatemala, Israel, Czech Republic, Montenegro, Bulgaria, Ukraine, Russia, Canada. And these were, that's because they were the best applicants that we chose. And if you include that, not only the people from outside the country, but people who are recent immigrants, it goes over half.
And if you think about even the countries, right? Montenegro, right? What the hell? But there's a Montenegrin edition now of Atlas Shrugged, right? It's been translated. Like Montenegrin's different than all the, you know, balkanization, right? This is the ultimate in balkanization. Montenegro like has 500,000 population, but there's a university in Montenegro, a private university in Montenegro. And I walked into the office of the guy who owns it. It's a private university and is the president of the university. And there's a stack of Ayn Rand's books, the fiction, nonfiction. And he says, yeah, I'm a huge fan of Ayn Rand. And we teach Ayn Rand here at the university. It's something's happening in these places that now I hope it's not just the decline of the U.S., which it to some extent is, but it's also this rise, dramatic rise of interest in these other countries, which I think is very exciting. I know a lot of Americans are skeptical, and I know a lot of Americans think I'm wasting my time. But
they should listen to your presentation from Brazil. You had them standing up and cheering from their seats. So keep it up.
It was fun. Thanks. Thanks. And I think the OAC numbers are a reflection that they're not just random people. They're smart kids. These are the smart kids. And it's also a reflection, I think, of the educational systems. You know, nobody in the world took progressive education quite as seriously as the United States did. So educational systems around the world might be still bad, but they're not quite as nutty as some of the stuff we do in the United States. And I think that's reflected. I see that in the UK for sure. They know more history. They're just more thoughtful. They're better critical thinkers than the average students in the U.S. And they know stuff. They've learned facts. Whereas in the U.S., they know nothing, which is scary. Jonathan, you had a second question?
I'll leave it there. Thank you again.
Sure. All right. Let me take a couple of these. We've got three super chat, and then we'll see what else we get. So this is, I guess, to me, given the likelihood of a new financial crisis, or maybe Jonathan, you can chime in. In the next few years, a new financial crisis in the next few years, what are some good investments to hedge against it that can be started now? I mean, I think it's really hard. I think it's really hard because it depends on the type of financial crisis we're going to get. Look, anytime you're talking about if it's a big financial crisis, if it's a really dramatic event, bigger than 2008, then you want to have some gold because gold is the asset class that people run to when things are going to hell. It's also protection against inflation, which could be the manifestation of the next financial crisis. But as we saw in 2008, a big part of the financial crisis of 2008 was massive deflation, the destruction of credit, the destruction of money, and a shrinkage of the real money supply of the real quantity of money. And that's why gold went up and then it went way down because it didn't survive because there wasn't actually growth in money. Money was all held in reserve. So what type of financial crisis is going to happen? You know, if you're going to have a financial crisis where all financial assets decline, then maybe the best thing to do is hold cash. Right. And so that you're in a position to buy cheap or you're positioned to figure out what to do when the financial crisis actually happens. But again, you're going to be killed if you hold cash and there's massive inflation. So it really depends on what is actually going to happen. I suspect this is just me. Right. I suspect that the next financial crisis is going to be a credit crisis. It's going to be a government credit and a corporate credit crisis. As interest rates go up, I believe that corporations, particularly corporations and governments, are going to have it be harder and harder. You can see it in Turkey right now. You can see it in Argentina right now. They had dollar-denominated debt. The dollar got stronger. Interest rates in dollars got higher. And suddenly, they can't buy enough of their local currency. They can't use enough of their local currency. They can't raise enough of their local currency to buy enough dollars to be able to pay back their debts. And so, and you're going to see that spreading along those countries in the third world that use dollar-denominated debt to fund their debts, you know, they could start collapsing. And a lot of that is private debt. A lot of that is corporate debt. But what happens in the U.S. where some companies that are way over-leveraged, they start collapsing. So how deep is it? How extensive is it? I just don't know. But I would say I would hold cash. Jonathan, you wanna chime in on this? He seems to be shaking his head. So I'm always.
You're on?
Yep. Go ahead. Sorry.
Since you're offering people to chime in, I'll chime in.
Sure.
I'm the chief investment officer of
my company. That's right.
If you're within 5 years of retirement, I would hold equities. You know, this country's, the stock market in this country and the developed world is extremely resilient. The financial crisis of 2008, from its peak in 2007, the S&P 500 recovered to back to its peak in 4 years.
Yep. Yeah, and it's made a lot of money since then. So
the day that they're not that the day they're not that resilient, we're gonna have bigger problems on our hands than our portfolio.
Yeah, and that's a crucial point. That is, if things are so bad that the market doesn't rebound, and look, during the Great Depression, it took the market from 29 or from the bottom in 30, it took it until the mid 1940s to recover. So it took 15 years. Over 15 years to fully recover. If you were in the NASDAQ in 1999 or in March of 2000, it took the NASDAQ, 15 years to recover to get back to the high?
Yeah.
Something close to that. So, yeah, generally, I think equities are what rebound the fastest. And if you're well diversified, but the Great Depression is a good example where it took 15 years for it to recover.
Yeah.
And if you'd been in cash, you might have done better. But the problem with cash is that you have to be a good market timer. And I don't know anybody.
Twice.
I don't know anybody. Mm-hmm. You have to know when to get out of the market, and then you have to know when to get back in. That's twice. And then when to get out, when it comes back down again, because the Great Depression, it didn't just go all the way down. It went down, then went up, and then went down, and went up, and it went down deeper. And mm-hmm. and how many times are you going to panic? How many times are you going to make the wrong decisions in between there? So if you think we're heading towards a Great Depression type environment where the equities will not recover, where equities are so expensive right now that it'll take them 15 years to recover, I don't see them as that expensive. I mean, there's no evidence that they're in crazy land. But there is evidence that our politicians are capable of doing really, 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 really stupid things. We've got Donald Trump as president, so anything is possible. When a recession happens, in terms of what happens, he could increase trade barriers like Hoover did in 30 and spiral us into a true Great Depression. So there's evidence in the Federal Reserve is better than it was in Great Depression. And a lot of why the Great Depression happened was because of bad Fed policy. So if you imagine that kind of crisis, then I would say be in gold and be in cash. But I can't imagine that kind of crisis anytime soon. I am widely diversified in equities. I don't hold bonds. I don't hold anything other than equities. I have a little bit in gold because there's a slight probability that the world will end, and I'd like to have a few gold coins with me when it does, to be able to barter for basic survival needs. But you know, prediction of doom and gloom are easy. And I did this talk, I think it's worth listening to, about how to be a rational optimist at OCON. There's so much good stuff going on in the world if you're willing to expand your sights beyond the United States. And I think the most important thing, we talked about loss of knowledge before. It would be so hard today to lose scientific and technological knowledge because it is so, it's everywhere, right? So it's not just the United States, it's not just Rome. The same scientific knowledge is today available in Thailand and China and in Australia and in India and in Israel and in Europe and in the US. And yeah, so that doesn't mean we're not going to have declines. We're definitely going to have declines. But to really lose the kind of knowledge, there's so many people doing math and science and engineering all over the world, that to really have the kind of dark ages that Rome experienced would require such a global cataclysm that I can't imagine seeing that in our lifetime. Again, I'm not very optimistic about the U.S., but even a decline in the U.S. is not the kind of dark ages post Rome. It looks differently. It's maybe an authoritarian decaying society, but it's not. We're back to subsistence farming, which is what happened in Rome. So if you think the markets are resilient, as Darius does, I share that. I would. Most of us should just stick through it, because most of us, 99.99% of us, are bad market timers. Even Warren Buffett, who's one of the great investors of all time, is not a good market timer. He holds for the long term, and that's how he's made his money. Jonathan, in on this? I'm sure the audience would love to hear what you have to say.
No, I got nothing. I'll defer, Gerald. Thank you.
All right. All right, I've got another question for Matthew. In your discussion of Me Too, you mentioned the need for open communication. At which point should an individual not bother trying to reason communicate with another individual about setting boundaries? I mean, I think that should be pretty straightforward, right? If you communicated clearly about what you believe the boundaries are, and the other person continuously violates your boundaries and whatever they are, and you've communicated them clearly, and you've made, you've objected on a number of occasions, that's it. Whether it's one, two, or three, I don't have a golden rule. Depends on your relationship with the other person. But if there's certain boundaries you have, and you're sure you've communicated what they are, and that they're violated, then dump them. stop it. You can't have people doing that. And granted, when it comes to intimate relationships, it's not always easy to communicate the boundaries. So make sure you're communicating effectively. Most people don't talk about sex clearly and impassionately. So, find a way to be a good communicator. Anybody else want to chime in? All right. That video, my Me Too video, is going like this. Because it's got the keyword Me Too, and I think it's popping up on a lot of people's channels, which just shows how important it is to have the right keywords. It is because they watch like a minute and then they click off. So the other thing, you get views and then you see how long people watch. It deflates you after you see the high views and then you see, oh, they only watch 3 minutes. Then it's deflating. All right. Alex asks, is verbal bullying free speech? Where's the line? I mean, that's hot. I think verbal bullying at some point becomes action and therefore is not free speech. But where's the line is hot. It's not easy. And what is verbal bullying? What is harassment? What is just somebody, being obnoxious? Where the exact lines? I don't think it's easy to define those things. But clearly, if somebody's threatening, that they have crossed the line, that is not speech anymore. That is action. If you have expressed to somebody, stop saying that. Again, communication, and they continue to be in your space, to violate your boundaries in a sense, then I think that has become an action and is no longer speech and is therefore actionable against. Ben, I'm sure you have something to say about this.
Not much more than what you did. I just want to say that I agree that, speech can be action, and it's important to remember that, somebody who's mugging you and saying your money or your life, in threatening force, they're using force.
Yep.
And that's important, especially when you think about the debates objectivists sometimes get into with libertarians, because one of the points that we make is that if you don't have a philosophic foundation, your understanding of political philosophy, you're not even going to be able to come close to answering these kinds of questions. What is force? Why is it wrong? When is it being used? I was recently working on a research project on the question of the relationship between force and political freedom. And I tried to look up what was even the libertarian view on what force is. And they have, there's not even really a literature. It's not even that it's a poorly thought out literature. It's that there isn't one that I can find.
Yeah.
Somebody shows me, I'll be grateful today. I'd like to look at it, but and that's because these are difficult questions. You know, Ankar Gatte sometimes tells the story about how when he was young, he was traveling with his family in a faraway country where there was a civil war going on. And his family was once, he drove up and there was a checkpoint and these soldiers with their guns asked for money. And were they just asking for a bribe or were they threatening? It's hard to say in a situation like that. But the fact that it might well have been the use of force is something that you have to think about when you're crafting policy to understand, well, how are we going to eliminate this fully? What sorts of actions and what sorts of conditions are impermissible in a civilized society? And I think this ties into some kinds of debates that we sometimes get into about gun control. And part of what makes gun control debate complicated.
You said it's complicated. Now you're a leftist. You know, you're in big trouble, Ben. You can't say that. I get more harassment on gun control than probably any other topic because I say it's complicated. But think about this. Think about the fact that if your neighbor blasts the audio at 2 a.m, you know, through the government has a role there to you have a right to call the police and have them stopped. That music is harassing you. It is doing something physical to you. And then if somebody is constantly in your face pestering you and you've asked them to stop and you've asked them to go away, it's very similar. The noise that they're making is truly physical action that is disturbing you, not just emotionally, but physically disturbing you. And all those distinctions, they're not easy. And they're not easy, you know, how many decibels is okay, how many decibels is not. What is, you know, are they in their face? Are they far away? This is why you have a court of law. This is why you have laws. This is why legislature actually needs to exist in a free society, because these issues, and there might be disagreements. So federalism might not be a bad idea here, where different jurisdictions have slightly different definitions of these things, as long as they're all approaching it from the same perspective of individual rights, because it might not be clear cut in all cases. But, you know, we discussed this about where's the age of consent. It's the same kind of thing. There are tricky lines to be drawn in reality, and it's one of the reasons you need philosophers of law and you need legislatures and you need courts in order to help define those lines and to figure out what exceptions to those.
Let me add one thing to just make sure that we bother to stick it to the left as well, because I think part of what's probably motivating a question about whether verbal threats constitute force is the allegations that are made by the left, and especially by advocates of various forms of political correctness, so-called, that using insensitive language counts as a microaggression or something like that. And there are student activists who say things like, this is a real threat. And it should, and therefore it's not free speech. Hate speech is not free speech, they'll say, and therefore should be outlawed in some form or another. And I mean, that's the opposite example of the same kind of confusion about how you need to have a philosophic understanding of the difference between speech and action, and how, you know, what makes the difference is, do you have an alternative in when you are faced with this verbiage? Can you, you know, if somebody's got a gun and they're saying, give us your money, you might not. But if what someone says is something insulting about your skin color or something like that, but they're, you have an alternative about how to process that. You can think, you know, this person is right, I'm a terrible person, or you can think this person is BSing and they don't know what they're talking about. Mm-hmm. And it feels bad, but I can walk away with it and fight another day.
And that would be the differentiation between harassment and non-harassment is, can you walk away? Or are they going to follow you and keep yelling at you and stand in your face and yell at you continuously in a context where, you know, not in a, you know, way where you can't walk away? Then it becomes harassment and then it becomes an action. So,
yes.
I like that way. What are your options? How do you have options in how to handle it? Can you, in a sense, walk away or can't you? How do you process the information? Is crucial to defining what these things are. All right, let's see. Let's do another round. I'm out of super chat questions. There's more money on the table, guys. There are more questions to be asked. So, Jennifer, do you have anything more?
Your Honor, a friend wanted me to ask you to explain what exactly a CEO does.
A CEO broadly?
Yeah, just the CEO in general.
Wow. I mean, from a perspective, kind of economic speak, a CEO is responsible for allocation of capital and human resources within an organization. So his job is to figure out what is the optimal way to use the resources of the organization to achieve the particular mission that the organization has. Think about the CEO of Apple and the job he's got to decide what to invest in the future. What kind of products are they going to invest in? Not just tomorrow, not just what am I going to launch next September, but he has to already have plans for what he's going to launch in 5 years, even though he probably doesn't have a clue what the technologies of 5 years are going to be. He has to already be able to try to outline what the technologies might look like and what kind of products, and then allocate resources and both monetary resources, capital, and people to figuring out what they're going to do in 5 years. What's going to happen in 4 years? What's going to happen in 3 years? What's going to happen in 2 years? And how do I sustain what I'm selling right now? So you have to allocate resources to your Apple stores and to the whole supply chain that manufactures the products to get them into the stores. And he has to coordinate all of that, both what is going to happen in the future and what is happening right now. Now, he doesn't have to do every single step there. He has to pick the people who are going to do that. So he has to appoint the right kind of people to do it. But he is still the one at the end of the day responsible for deciding how much of the firm's capital, how much resources, how much energy, how much focus is going to be given to each one of these activities. So he's responsible for the entire division of labor and division of capital within an organization. And the bigger, more complex an organization, the tougher that is. And that's why there are very few very large corporations that succeed long term. I would argue that one of the ways, if you want to beat the market, is bet against conglomerates, because conglomerates are not sustainable long term. Now, what is the long term is a hard point, but there are very few genius CEOs who can actually run a conglomerate, who can actually run a large business of any type. And this is why they get so much money. They get so much money because very few people can do it. It's a matter of the amount of information that they have to integrate, the amount of knowledge that they have to have, and then just the number of concrete decisions that they have to make given all this integrated knowledge. And they are both the internal face, and then there's a whole aspect of the external face of having to raise money, of having to deal with shareholders, of having to deal with bondholders, of having to deal with the press and politics. Today, you have to be a minor politician as a CEO because you have to go to Washington, you have to have dinner with Trump, and you have to be nice, and all, which I think is very hard and requires real genius. So I can't think of a more complex job than the CEO of a large publicly traded corporation today in the world. Far, like it's light years more complex than what a politician has to do, or what a president has to do, far more complex than what a small business owner has to do. I mean, we venerate small business, but the real wonder in the world is the achievements of big business and because of the level of integration they have to deal with and the success. So when you see a successful CEO who's really, really good at what they do, wow, that's like Michelangelo. I mean, it's it's a level of genius that very few people actually attain. And that's why this, by the way, CEOs of large businesses don't last on average more than, I think, 5 years is the number or something like that. So there's this huge amount of turnover because very few of them are good. So the board kicks them out very quickly, right? And it's also a very difficult life because of the amount of work that one has to do, just the amount of energy one has to expend in order to do it.
Yeah.
Sure,
thanks. So I have a question in regards to Rand's introduction to objectivist epistemology, the book.
Yep.
Yeah, so as someone who's never taken an academic course in philosophy, I'm very curious, what material in that book is fundamental, would be seen in any introduction to epistemology academic course, and which material is specific to objectivism? So there's like material, there's measurement and definitions. I would guess that that's fundamental to kind of all epistemology courses, and then there's the axiomatic concepts of existence, consciousness, and identity, which I suspect are objectivist only.
So I'm gonna let Ben answer this because I've never taken a formal philosophy class either, so I have no idea. I mean, I have my suspicions, so I'm curious to see if Ben confirms my suspicions.
The brief answer to the question is that nearly all of the topics in Introduction to Objectivist Epistemology are topics that most philosophers don't even recognize as being relevant to epistemology, believe it or not. And there's a long story for why that's true. These days, and it's been this way for 70 years or so, the major questions that epistemologists believe their field is concerned with are questions like, what is knowledge? What is what they call justification of knowledge? How do we define the concept of knowledge, and do we have any? The Ayn Rand's book, Introduction to Objectivist Epistemology, is, as you know, primarily a theory of concept formation.
Yeah.
And most philosophers are going to ask the question, why is that relevant to understanding what knowledge is or whether we have any or how we get it? And you may be wondering, why would they think that? Why would that not seem relevant? Because isn't our knowledge built up out of concepts? And the reason that they don't is because they think it's a psychological issue and not a philosophical issue. And that's because they don't think that there are any norms that you can define for concept formation. They think concepts are just, we're given them, or we're either born with them or they automatically evolve in the course of our experience. But there's no such thing as a valid concept or an invalid concept. There's just the concepts that we have, and some combinations of them constitute knowledge and some don't, in their view. But I think what this points to is what's really unique about Ayn Rand's view, which is precisely that she does think there are norms governing our concepts, that there are valid and invalid concepts. And that's much of what ITOE is concerned with defining, that, you know, beginning with even the most basic perceptual level concepts, there are certain norms that guide them. But then certainly how to define a concept, you need to define it in terms of essentials, not in terms of superficial characteristics. Your concepts need to not involve package deals. They certainly need to not be anti-concepts where they eliminate from discussion some valid concept. For more on this, I really recommend taking a look at two sources. One is if you look up the companion to Ayn Rand, which is edited by Greg Salmieri and Alan Gotthelf. There's a chapter in there that Dr. Salmieri authored called The Objectivist Epistemology. And there's a section in that chapter on this issue of conceptual norms. I can't remember what the section is called. But there's also a good essay by Greg in the Ayn Rand Society Studies volume. It's called Reflections on Objectivist Epistemology. This is the second volume of it. And he's got a chapter in there called Conceptualization and Justification, which especially that one really shows why Ayn Rand thought her book was an introduction to epistemology, but it explains it in a way that is speaking to academic audience who wouldn't understand that and trying to bridge the gap in understanding, and really a really good essay from that perspective.
Thank you.
Jonathan?
Quickly, Yaron, I don't want to be too dark, but I wanted to ask you this. Obviously, it's always said that objectivism is a philosophy for living on Earth. So my question to you is, beyond getting your financial affairs in order, what would you do, Yaron, if you found out that you only had a year to live?
Hi. I don't know. I mean, I'd probably figure out what are the experiences that were most important for me that I really wanted to do before I died. You know, things that maybe I'm putting off right now and I haven't given it the thought. And I would, so I think the kind of the bucket list concept, if it was, you know, more than just superficial, if it was more meaningful, I think is a useful idea, right? What are the things you really want to experience in life? Stuff you want to see, stuff you want to do, that you'd like to do. But I don't know that much of my life would change that much, because what I do is what I enjoy doing, right? And it's not that I do stuff now because I think, oh, this will benefit me in 10 years, so I'm doing it now. I think it will, but I'm also doing it because I'm enjoying it right now. But certainly anything that I think that is more of a long-term investment, I would liquidate, right? So I would get out of and focus on things that were more, that I would enjoy in the short run, that would give me more pleasure right now, pleasure and satisfaction right now. And I haven't thought of it, so I don't know what exactly that would look like. I can actually think of stuff, but I'm not going to say it. Yeah, Ben.
There's a really interesting book by Neville Shute, On the Beach, which plays with this idea. And unlike, you know, most people who face this question, it's not that the people in the novel are sick or anything, that there's been a nuclear catastrophe and there's radiation slowly coming toward Australia, and they know it's going to reach them eventually, and they have to make this decision. And it's interesting to look at the way the different characters make the decision.
Yeah.
And there was a movie too.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's a depressing book. So it's atypical of Neville Shute in that sense.
But it's still really interesting for a depressing book.
But it's, I don't know that there's a, I very much think, because you're given this finite situation, it's very dependent on your particular hierarchy of values and what are you doing right now in your job. So for example, if you're somebody who's got a clear career path, taking certain steps, and you imagine yourself in a particular place in 10 years, and it's everything gears towards that, and suddenly 10 years is out and you've got 1 year, then that career for that 1 year doesn't necessarily still make the same sense it did before, when you could plan in terms of 10 years. Now your horizon shrinks to 1 year. And just like your investments would be different if you shrunk your investment horizon to 1 year, I think the way you manage your life would be different if you shrunk your horizon to 1 year. And I think it would be very individual in terms of how you would respond to that. And there's no good answer, because having a horizon of 1 year sucks, right? And that's part of the recognition of it. It's not good, right? But there's also a sense in which you want to live every day like it's your last day in some sense, right? You want to live it fully, because you're never going to get the second back. You're never going to get this hour back. So it wouldn't change that much. It would change certain things, but it wouldn't change your overall perspective on life, hopefully. All right. I have three super chat questions. How do I schedule a talk with you at my university? email me at yaron@yaronbrookshow.com. yaron@yaronbrookshow.com. What, according to you, are the best countries to immigrate to for the long term? It used to be easy to answer that question. I'd say come to the U.S. I'm not as convinced as I used to be. I still think of all the places in the world, this is the most interesting, where you have the most opportunities, where there's the most stuff happening. You still have a lot of freedom in the U.S. in spite of everything. If you're in, I don't know, depending on the field in which you're active in, you know, the best universities in the world. If you're an engineer, still in the U.S. If you want to do a startup, Silicon Valley is the best place to do a startup, still in the world. So it really depends who and what you are and what your ambitions are. I've also said that, you know, New Zealand's amazing. It's beautiful. It's pretty from an economic freedom perspective. It's, I think, number three in the world. The United States is like 15 or 18 or 13, depending on which year exactly you look and which measure you look at. You know, if you're in Europe and you want to stay in Europe, I am shocked why more people don't move to Ireland. Ireland is what everybody thinks Sweden is. Like, everybody thinks Sweden is this rich, successful, happy society. No, Sweden's a dump. And it's depressing and it's dark and it's cold and people are not that rich. It's like it would be the 40th state in the U.S. if it was a state in terms of income per capita. Like, Ireland would be number one. Average income in Ireland on a GDP per capita basis is higher than, I think, any state in the U.S. It's the richest country of significance in Europe today. And it's become rich really, really fast. And it's become rich because they've liberated their economy. It's the least regulated economy in Europe. It's some of the lowest taxes in Europe. It's got a lot of high tech in Ireland. So if you're in Europe, I would go to Ireland. So, you know, it really depends. If you're in, you know, some places, if you're in the Middle East, get out or go to Israel. Although if you're a Muslim, it's a little difficult. You know, if you're in the Middle East, anywhere you go in the world is better than where you are today. Right. Try to get to the U.S. But generally, the Anglo-Saxon world, the world that speaks English, is better than the rest of the world. I think because of ideas, because they internalized the Enlightenment in ways that the rest of the world didn't, because it was more influenced by the Germans and the French. So Australia, New Zealand, Canada, the United States, UK, Ireland, some of the best places in the world to live as compared to other places. Do you have anything to add? Anybody have anything to add?
You've traveled way more than me.
Oh, Switzerland. Switzerland is good. That's right. Switzerland in Europe is the one exception. Because I think of the way they structured themselves politically, the bad ideas had less influence on Swiss society than in the politics of Swiss society than they did elsewhere in Europe. So within Europe, Switzerland is a good choice. Although I still, just look at the numbers, put aside everything else, numbers, I would prefer Ireland to Switzerland. Scenery, quality of life, probably Switzerland is better if you like the cold. I don't. Is anarchism compatible with objectivism and capitalism? I'm surprised I'm still asked this question, given that I respond to it like in every talk I get this question. No, 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 and no. So there's no such thing as anarcho-capitalism because anarchism is not capitalism. It cannot be capitalism. Capitalism is the system where there is a government and the government's job is to protect individual rights, primarily property rights. It's not a system that has no government, that is, has no monopoly over the use of force, retaliatory force, and has no entity with the responsibility of protecting individual rights, is not a capitalist society. So anarchism is not compatible with capitalism, and it's certainly not compatible with objectivism. Again, for the same reason, we view in politics, in the protection of individual rights, an entity protecting individual rights, as crucial for freedom as and philosophically crucial for human success and the ability of individuals to pursue their self-interest. So you cannot have the full manifestation of the objectivist morality, that is a full manifestation of egoism, in a society that is not protecting individual rights. And anarchism does not protect individual rights. Ben, you look like you're eager to jump.
I'll just supplement what you said because I agree with it. There's a set of videos that we just added to the ARI YouTube channel from last year's student conference in Atlanta, which was on the topic of Ayn Rand's view of liberty. And if you go to the playlists section of the channel, the playlist is called What is Liberty? And it deals with a lot of the questions that come up in connection with this issue related to what's the relationship between objectivism and libertarianism, but also, especially since so many libertarians are anarchists, why objectivism rejects anarchy and why the usual arguments given in favor of anarchy involve various kinds of fallacies. Some nice, good, and short, it's a short series of videos. There's probably going to be a little bit more going up later too, but I recommend that. And I'll also mention that the Ayn Rand Society, the academic association that's related to the American Philosophical Association, is going to be publishing their third volume soon. And it's
finally
on the topic of political philosophy.
Yep.
Called The Foundations of Capitalism. And there's going to be a number of essays in there as well. A whole exchange between Harry Binswanger and Michael Humer. And I think Greg Salmiri added an additional reply to that series, also related to this question.
Good. Yeah, so definitely go and find the playlist. It's in the Ayn Rand Institute YouTube channel. There's a ton of good content there, but this one's on liberty. And I think Greg Salamieri and Harry Binswanger both talked explicitly about anarchy, but I think Ankar Gatte also had some Q&A on it or was in his talk. So there's a lot of content there that's relevant to this question. But no, the answer is no, and then why? There's a lot to say about it, and that is, I think, right now the best source for that material on it. All right. I think we've gone for an hour and a half, which is longer than what everybody recommends I do, but it's more fun. So thanks everybody. Thanks to my Patreon supporters. Thank you for you guys for contributing so much. Thanks Ben for joining me a second time in a few days to
Definitely
do this.
Fun.
It really was more fun to have you here and have somebody else answer some of the questions and do a better job than I could have done. And yeah, thanks to all the listeners. Thank you all, guys. Share. Oh, we've got one more question. I have to take this. What is NOK? What currency is NOK?
Norwegian crown.
Norwegian crown. So I don't know how much this is, if this is real money. 50 Norwegian crown. I don't know. Jonathan 80? can look it up. I think this is a quick one. Veganism under objectivism. Why is it okay to kill animals to eat when vegans often show to have the longest lifespan? So I'm not going to get into the question of who has the longest lifespan. I don't know the science here, and I don't know the empirical evidence, but I've never seen proof one way or the other. And when I did look at it, it looked like these numbers were all over the place, and there was no clear cut proof that vegans live longer. Ben, you look like you have.
I would just add that it warrants being skeptical about any.
Yeah.
Dietary advice you pick up on the internet, not just about veganism, but about...
Well, or in books, or in academia, or in anything right now, because there's this huge amount of lack of knowledge. And I think we're just starting to understand nutrition. We're starting to understand... I saw a talk recently by an Israeli scientist who was arguing that because each one of us, actually given our genetic makeup, has an optimal diet that's individualized to us. But then there's a whole argument about that. So, I mean, there's a lot within the scientific community. There's a lot of debate and discussion and disagreement about these issues. And I think we're just starting to get a good understanding of what's involved. We're far from any kind of definitive answers, certainly about something like veganism, but anything regarding diet. There's certain things we know are poison, but even there's still debate about other things that might not be poison. But then in terms of killing animals, you know, animals don't have rights. They are not human beings. They are not reasoning beings. And there's no reason not to kill them. We're carnivores. We evolved to eat animals, from everything I can tell. And they taste good. And why not? Ben, you have a better, more philosophical answer than that.
No, I basically agree with that. I would just add that I mean, I can see, aside from dietary and nutrition reasons, how some people could have legitimate and rational reasons for wanting to not eat animals, just based on, you know, what were their relationships with animals when they grew up? Did they have a lot of pets? Did they grow up on a farm? If the way that animals are raised in this country for you know, mass production is not the happiest thing to think about. And if it makes you really unhappy to think about it when you eat it and you have some other alternative form of diet that's equally nutritious, there's nothing wrong with that, I don't think. But that's not true for everybody.
Yeah. Yeah. And you know, and there are other ways of raising animals. So there's actually, you can buy meat that is killed and raised differently and all that stuff. So there are other ways around it. Brian, I think he's the anarchist, says he challenges me to $100 to debate him for 15 minutes on anarchy. I talk to an echo chamber and I don't know what anarchy is. Brian, I don't mind debating you for 15 minutes, particularly if you're paying $100, I'll take you up on it. But I will note this. Every single public talk I've ever given, an anarchist has stood up and tried to do exactly what you do. The idea that I talk to an echo chamber is just ludicrous. Most of my life, I'm talking to non-objectivists who disagree, and most of the times anarchy is well represented. I know David Friedman, I know Huma, I know almost all the leading anarchists in the world today. I won't say I've debated every one of them, but I've certainly engaged with every one of them. Bring it on. I can't say I enjoy the debate about anarchy. I don't, because I feel like I've said everything I've got to say about it, and I've done it so many times. It bores me. It's not that interesting. But what, you know, there are a lot of you, particularly young, and so I think it's important to engage in that debate, because along it, young people are attracted to these ideas. So even though it bores me, I'll do it out of a sense of obligation and duty to the cause. I'm kidding. I don't believe in obligation and duty. All right. Thanks, everybody. Have a great rest of your weekend, and I will talk to you tomorrow, interviewing Larry Salzman. Should be a lot of fun. We're going to talk about public interest law, which is a really cool topic. All right. Thanks, Ben.
Thank you.
Thanks, Jonathan. Thank you. Jennifer. Thanks, Darius. Bye, everybody.
Bye.